This is an interview with Joseph A. Herzenberg, H-E-R-Z-E-N-B-E-R-G, for the Southern Oral History Program's new series, The North Carolina Politics Project. The date is July 27, 1995. The interview is being conducted at the home of the interviewer, Joe Monnier, M-O-S-N-I-E-R, graduate student in the History Department at Chapel Hill. The cassette number is 7.27.95-JH.
Joe, I thought to start, we could begin with, if you could give a description, brief recount of your personal biography, kind of maybe through the time of your arrival here in Chapel Hill. And in some regards, this shouldn't be brief, or I'll ask further questions, say, about all your Mississippi experiences.
Okay, I was born on the 25th of June, 1941, which incidentally is the day the Civil Rights Movement began. That is to say, it's the day that President Roosevelt issued Executive Order 8802 in response to, I mean, I think it's legitimate to say that because in response to black protests led by Philip Randolph, the president responded by issuing this non-discrimination order. Of course, I didn't know that at the time that I was born. I grew up in this small town, small mining town, Franklin, New Jersey. It's in extreme northwestern New Jersey. It's a company town, and my parents, my family, were one of the few families in the town that did not work for the mining company, the New Jersey Zinc Company. My father and his father before him owned a small drug store and were part of the very small Jewish community in this town. My mother was not Jewish, which always had some interesting tensions connected to it. I do think, again, in retrospect, since I didn't think about this at the time, that the first thing that I can actually remember, outside of a few family things, is the day FDR died. I mean, I wasn't even 4 years old. I was ill that winter, and my mother and I went to visit my grandparents in Florida. And why I remember the day, because I wouldn't otherwise, is that everybody cried. My mother, my grandparents, and the black woman who was their maid. It was a really sad occasion. I don't think I understood it at the time, but I just think it's in connection with my own political interest, that's the first thing that I can recall. And I grew up in this small town. I went to the public school there. I graduated from it and went to Yale, where I stayed for 5 years. I got a BA in history, mainly non-U.S. history. And I stayed on for an extra year and got an MA. I flirted with becoming a medieval historian. And I think at the time I was in New Haven, Yale was a pretty conservative college. That is, as far as the student body was concerned, not the faculty. But this was before coeducation, which made things very, very different. There were only 4 or 5 blacks in my class out of 1,000, and they weren't particularly interested in politics. They were mainly the sons of fairly well-to-do black people, one who was a vice president of Ford Motors, for example. But the most, I think, in retrospect, the most significant thing I did in those 5 years, in terms of what happened to me later on, was that I was quite active in the New Haven Core chapter in 63 and 64, and it was pretty radical for a core chapter. In fact, at one point, it was threatened with suspension from the national organization for going too far in certain matters. And it was overwhelmingly black. The membership of the organization had a lot of whites on it, but they weren't really active. There were only 2 or 3 other whites who regularly were active in this organization. I worked on housing issues, which mainly meant picketing landlords or slum housing. It was a very interesting experience all around.
What motivated you to get involved in civil rights?
I think I had a really close friend who made me feel a little guilty. His name was David Rudenstein. He was the treasurer of something called the Northern Student Movement, which was sort of friends of SNCC in the North. And he had done his senior thesis. I'd known him in college, and he also stayed on and got an MA for an extra year, and we roomed together that extra year. He had spent his summers in college in Prince Edward County, Virginia, and had done his MA thesis, done his senior honors thesis on it. And I just admired what he'd done a lot, and as I say, even felt a little guilty about it. Mm-hmm. So I just saw an announcement of a meeting, and I went, and I kept on going to these meetings, and mainly, I was very shy. It was very hard for me to walk a picket line. I remember the black kids who lived in some of this slum housing even threw rocks at us sometimes. But it was a very interesting group of people. Among its members were two black women in the law school, Marion Wright and what's her name? Eleanor Holmes were both members of the. They were a little older than me, and I didn't really know them very well. And there were other really distinguished black graduate students who were involved at a time when Yale didn't have very many. The law school had a fair bunch, and then there were all these blacks in the community. It was just a very interesting experience. You know, the black community in New Haven was started just a few yards away from my dorm at Yale, but there was very little interaction at the time between students. Now, there were liberal faculty who were more in touch with things, but not students, believe me. Mm-hmm. There were some who worked at the equivalent of the Campus Y, you know, social service agencies, but not all that many. So it was a very interesting experience.
Did that kind of work push you off with your family at all?
Well, I don't think so. I think maybe if I had gone a little further and been arrested or something, that would have gotten a little worried. But my parents, and this was true with I had two brothers. One of them is now dead, and my dead brother David was very active in our home county, where I never was. He led the anti-war movement in this rural county, New Jersey. I think my parents are both dead now, they were just very supportive of their sons. So even when they didn't agree, my father did not agree with David about the war, and I remember hearing an argument between the two of them about flag burning once. My father did not believe in burning the flag. And my brother had, although it wasn't, there was no proof, had once painted the town war memorial yellow with something like, you know, come home on it. And I think even there, my mother was more supportive, was sort of proud of what he'd done. He'd stood up for what he believed in, that kind of thing. So, no, I don't, when I went to Mississippi, I think they were a little worried. There was an awful morning when the night before the Ku Klux Klan had blown up my next door neighbor's house, and I slept through the whole thing.
This is
in Tougaloo, in Mississippi, and I didn't learn of this explosion until my mother called me at 6 in the morning when she heard about it on the Today Show back in New Jersey, and of course she was quite worried. But they really never said. They were generally pretty supportive of everything.
Can you tell me the story of your transition from Yale down to Mississippi?
Well, it's not a simple matter. One always tries to. It's easy to put motivation in very simple terms, but I had had a kidney removed at the end of my senior year in college. In my year in graduate school, I was really exhausted. I'd never really recovered. And my advisors, my faculty advisors, the professor did not like the idea that I was spending 2 hours a day on the picket line during most of this time. And so I decided that I would leave Yale after my MA and come back at some later time. And I had worked with a friend, a woman who was in the law school. She had a little personal program where in the summer, in Freedom Summer, summer of 64, she had placed Yale and other Ivy League, but mainly Yale, graduate students in Southern Black colleges as sort of their way of, this is a, you know, I think she may have placed 20 or 30 students. She just, it was her own little project. I even forget her name. I remember in the course of that summer reading the letters from the students, graduate students, who went off and were having a great time teaching at these, and some of them were friends of mine, in particular a guy who was teaching at Philander Smith College in, not in Little Rock, but the other city in Arkansas. I also knew a few people who had been students at Black colleges. My friend, David Rudenstein, had dated for a long time Karen Kunstler's, Bill's oldest daughter, and she had been a student at Tougaloo. And she and I were friends, and she talked about how interesting it was to be a white student at a Southern Black college. So it really seemed like an interesting thing to do, and I, after living in New Haven for 5 years, I thought I could only be happy living in a large city, compared to my hometown. So I wrote all the Black colleges in Atlanta and New Orleans, most of whom didn't even respond. But one day, I saw that Tougaloo needed a historian, and I wrote them, and they hired me. And went down.
So you went down there when?
I was hired on the 1st of September, 64, and got there a couple of weeks later.
Yeah.
It was very hot.
So what was your time like? Tell me about your experience at Tougaloo.
Well, it was in many ways, it was the most interesting years in my life. It was just, it's so hard after 30 years to remember how odd the kind of mix was of it was so far removed from anything I was accustomed to. And this was true of a large portion of our faculty. Our faculty was overwhelmingly white. Blacks were in, you have to put it, traditional Black departments, education, music, physical education. There was actually initially not a single Black professor in the social sciences. There were some in English, for example, but they were overwhelmingly white Northern liberals who were, you know, really latter day abolitionists. And the college had been founded right after the war, early in Reconstruction, by real abolitionists, and I think most of us thought we were just picking up on where they left off. I don't mean to say our students were hopelessly removed from what we had experienced in places like Yale or Oberlin or Carleton, where the faculty came from. But because they were still almost the elite in terms of the graduates of the Black high schools of Mississippi, very few, only a very tiny portion of those Black high school graduates went to white colleges anywhere, or a few went to Fisk or Morehouse or Spelman, places like that. But most of those people who were steered by Tougaloo alumni, who were principals and guidance counselors at the Black high schools, to their own alma mater, which was clearly the best place in Mississippi for a Black to get a college education in those days. May still be, for all I know. But the year that I arrived was not a good year. In the spring of 64, there were moves in the legislature to revoke the college's charter because of its, it really was singular in how active the college was in the civil rights movement. With all due respects to A&T and other places, at Tougaloo, a couple hundred students, a couple dozen faculty, and the college president had all been arrested in a sit-in at the Woolworths in down Jackson. That was the year before I got there. And the Jackson Daily News and Clarion Ledger, which were about as awful newspapers as could be in this country at the time, regularly called Tougaloo Cancer College and had editorials and editorial cartoons attacking the college for not doing what it ought to be doing, teaching contented, happy Negroes, but for stirring up race relations in Mississippi. And it was the college chaplain, who was the only white, well, he and his wife were the only white Southerners on our faculty, you know, was regarded as, according to Look magazine, as the most hated white man, that is, by other white people in Mississippi, Ed King. And I failed to continue explaining. So the freshman class at Tougaloo was not as good as it ordinarily was because people were afraid the college wasn't even going to be there or be open. And so some of those people who might have come that year, 64, 65, didn't, and we had a lower quality freshman class. And there were a couple of people who were functionally illiterate, and a large number, not all, but a large number really were not ready for college work and needed a lot of remedial work. There always were, even in that worst year, and I stayed there 5 years, there always were at least some really good students who made it all worthwhile.
What did you teach?
I taught, well, almost all kinds of history possible, because I taught world history, and I taught Russian history, British history, historiography for senior majors. I got stuck my second year teaching the Mississippi and the South course, which you had to take if you're going to get a teaching certificate. And that was quite good for me, because I actually shifted my interest to Southern history after all that. And we also had a sort of experimental Ford Foundation-funded freshman seminar program in history and social sciences, which was focused on sort of American studies. But I really taught everything. Africa. I mean, some things I knew very little about, but they had to be taught, so someone had to teach them.
What led you to the choice of Chapel Hill and Frank Porter Graham? Was Frank Porter Graham already on your mind?
No. Although I was aware of him. After 5 years, the president of the college refused to give me more than a one-year contract at a time, because he thought that people like me should go back and get PhDs. And that was good, I think. And it didn't actually work in most cases. The kind of people the Tougaloo white faculty were actually were not likely to get PhDs in many cases. And that was certainly also the case with me. And then my last year there were just enough unpleasantnesses with regard to black power. I mean, it still was overall a positive experience, but I was teaching the black history course, you know, which ironically the black faculty didn't want taught. They were all integrationists. They believed that black history should be taught in the context of overall U.S. history, and didn't think a separate course was advisable. But the whites who taught black history, black anthropology, black political science, were pretty easy targets for black power radicals. And I had very mixed feelings about that. Some of those were my best students. At times it was more than slightly unpleasant. So it was a good time to go back to graduate school. And I actually spent too much time trying to get a couple of my best students into, got one into Princeton and one into Washington University in St. Louis. And when that was over, it was already June and not exactly easy to get into graduate schools. So a friend of mine suggested that I apply here. I remember all he said was, I think you'll like Chapel Hill, it's a pretty place. I think then he mentioned a few people, including Joel Williamson across the street. And so I applied, and I applied on my birthday, June 25th, and I think a few weeks later I got a letter from Frank Klingberg, a form letter, saying, come on. So that was it.
What was Chapel Hill like when you got here?
Well, I don't know, because I was pretty determined, at least for 2 or 3 years, that I was going to go back to Mississippi as soon as possible. And I did go back often. I always went for graduation, for example, because my students were always graduating. And I'd go back a couple of other times during the course of the year. And I really didn't have much interest in Chapel Hill for the first 2 or 3 years. I was a fairly devoted graduate student. I walked from my apartment to either Wilson Library or to Saunders Hall, where the history department was, and walked back. And, you know, I think for a while I thought this was the biggest place I'd ever lived in, because I knew almost nobody here. It was sort of odd. And that was the case until the McGovern campaign.
Did Stonewall in 68 have any, was that part of the landscape of your...
No, not at all. Partly because in the summer of 69, I spent the whole summer basically moving here, including finding an apartment, having my furniture and furnishings moved, and I went to a wedding in Cleveland, Ohio, and visited some white Tougaloo students who lived in North Dakota. You know, I just traveled around, and I don't really know when I heard of Stonewall. I think I was subscribing to the Village Voice then. I think it eventually caught up with me, maybe in October. You know, 3 or 4 months after it happened, I read about it.
Yeah.
But not at the time.
Yeah. Did you have any sense of local town politics when you got here? Doesn't sound like you would have been paying a lot of attention.
No, I had a little, because, well, first of all, Howard Lee's election in May as the first black mayor in a white southern town, that was quite a distinction. And a great deal was made about it, deservedly so, at the time. And, you know, I had a general idea that the place was liberal. I mean, I had read enough southern history, not a lot, but what I mainly read was black stuff and not white southern history, or white liberal southern history. So I had some idea of the that this was not just any old North Carolina college town. This was indeed a pretty special place. And when I got here, you know, older graduate students, particularly people whose political sensibilities were similar to mine, they told me all kinds of stories. I mean, the cafeteria worker strike had been the previous year, and I had a lot of sort of political gossip about which professor had observed and which had violated the picket line. It's interesting that now the new chancellor, you know, was actually a student who was involved in the student support for the strike. Very different from those days. And at the end of my very first year here was the incursion, as they called it, into Cambodia. And the university was shut down for the better part of a week. It was officially shut down for one day. And there was a general meeting of the whole faculty that a lot of graduate students went to listen to, and that kind of thing was not happening in Columbia, South Carolina, or Athens, Georgia. You knew that.
Right. If I can turn the conversation in the direction of your experiences across the early and mid-70s, and you become involved in that time in Democratic Party politics here in Chapel Hill and so forth. So can you explain sort of what you were up to in the early years of the 70s?
Well, of course, even in Mississippi, I was nominally active in the skeletal structure of the Freedom Democratic Party. When I came here, I didn't do anything until I think I sort of felt a little bad about not having done more about the war. Because in Mississippi, we had our own war, and I actually was, as far as I know, was the first anti-war demonstration in Jackson. All we did was take a letter to the Catholic bishop. The Pope had made a peace initiative. We supported the Pope. So I hadn't done much. I never, at least in his heyday, participated in the famous Franklin Street anti-war vigils. So when McGovern ran, it seemed like he was someone who could help. And I got involved in precinct politics here. We had a great local McGovern campaign. I mean, we really got out the vote in large numbers. Not that it helped in the big picture. And then after the campaign, I ended up, I had sort of enjoyed precinct politics. And even though I'd never thought about it very much, it actually was in many ways replicating what my father and grandfather, both of whom were active in local politics in Franklin, had done. My grandfather had been on the first borough council and school board back early in the century. My father had been on both of those boards as well. And even though they weren't as organized as we were in Chapel Hill, they didn't do much door-to-door. I found it fun to do.
Before I ask more about the local politics, you mentioned before we turned the tape on that you had been a delegate.
Yes.
Can you explain that story?
What happened was, I believe, Freedom Democrats were offered token seating in Atlantic City in 64. They were officially seated in Chicago in 68. Right? The irony there is, that convention was a debacle as far as the Democratic Party was concerned. But as far as the Freedom Democrats Party was concerned, it was wonderful. And in 72, there was a compromise effort, I believe, where the Freedom Democrats filled half of the delegation and then offered the regular Democrats the rest of the delegation. But they didn't bite. They didn't go for that. And in fact, they specifically repudiated the whole thing. And so at the last minute, there was a need to fill out the rest of the delegation. And I got this call from a friend, from John Dittmer, and who asked if was I willing to go. Initially, I was only a kind of third-rate member of the delegation, but then some other people didn't show up, so I was promoted and I was an alternate. And I did get to vote because I persuaded a delegate to leave the floor so I could vote on the first time a gay rights issue had ever come up at a national convention. The McGovern people were against the gay rights proposal because they already were anti-war. They were assumed to be for marijuana and for draft evasion and God knows what else. So they didn't want to take on gay rights. And the official line was that the McGovern people should vote against this, although some of them, of course, did not vote against it. And I'm not sure how much I knew of this all in advance, but I was just sitting here hearing this delegate from San Francisco speak about it, so I asked, there were about four or five Tougaloo faculty in the delegation, and I asked one of them if I wanted to vote on this. He said, sure, so I voted for it.
No, that's right. You were there nominally
McGovern.
No, right.
Yes.
Through the Mississippi, the regular Mississippi?
No, the Freedom Democrats.
Okay, so they filled out the remaining.
Yes,
right,
yes. That's right. Okay. It was really, the PR for that convention was supposed to be awful. You know, the great speeches were at 3 in the morning, but I wasn't watching the television. I was there, And it was, I got to meet all these people. I remember a really nice conversation I had with Julian Bond, who just stopped by our delegation. And it was a great event in my life. Mm-hmm.
So when you came back to Chapel Hill in 72 after the convention and worked in precinct politics, can you describe sort of how the party organized here locally?
Well, see, what happened is, if I can step back a few years, historically, local politics in Chapel Hill were a fairly small, closed system where, for example, downtown business people and university administrators had run the local government. It was a fairly limited local government. And that all changed when Howard Lee and there was a revolution in 69 when Howard Lee and his allies were elected, and they had, for the first time, a liberal activist. I don't mean to say their predecessors did nothing. I mean, there were public housing projects before Howard Lee, but Howard Lee's attitude was entirely different, and of course the bus system was the big symbol of the change. But one thing that helped Howard get elected was the organizing that had been done within the Democratic Party for Gene McCarthy in the year before. And in many ways, for about 10 years, 8 years certainly, beginning with McCarthy in 68, there was a pretty much where the Democratic Party precinct structures were what amounted to politics in Chapel Hill. That is, if you were running for Board of Aldermen, as it was called then, or mayor, the people who helped you beyond your own personal friends were the Democratic precinct structure. That worked until the mid or middle late 70s when the precinct structures started to deteriorate. But most of the people who ran for local office were on these committees, and that's how I sort of got dragged in. Somebody on our committee here in East Franklin, Jerry Cohen, who was already on the Board of Aldermen, he was elected in 73, he ran for mayor in 75, and I asked him one day how I could help, and I became his campaign treasurer, which was a great way to get to know people all over town, because when a check came in, you said, who is this person? And why is it so small or so big? I did the same thing. Jerry lost when he ran for mayor that year, but he ran for re-election to the Board of Aldermen 2 years later, and I did the same thing then. And then in 79, I had encouraged the very young son of my major professor to run for Board of Aldermen. And Bruce Tindall agreed to do that. And I was going to be his campaign manager. I was really, in many ways, too shy, I thought, to run for office myself. And as time went on, I kept on bugging Bruce, you know, when's the campaign going to start? And he finally decided he wasn't going to run. So in a very atypical and impetuous way, I decided to run myself. The irony is that Bruce later changed his mind and ran and lost. But that's his story. I didn't win, but I was the biggest loser. That is, I was the loser with the most votes. And my old friend Jerry Cohen was running for mayor again that year, and he had announced that if he lost, he not only wouldn't be mayor, but he was going to resign his seat on the town council. And he did, and I was appointed to the vacancy. I served 2 years and then was defeated when I ran for 81, largely, not entirely, but largely because we had voted to site a housing project in a neighborhood that didn't want it. And the black member of council who was up that year and I were defeated. Mm-hmm. I also didn't have a very good campaign. I never in these early years had very good campaigns. I learned a lot later on. I ran to try to get my seat back in 85, by which time I was out of the closet. I again had a kind of mediocre campaign. I did fairly well, but didn't win. And then in 87, I finally had a really well-organized campaign and did very well and won.
Let me go back for a moment to, before asking about the specifics of your campaigns for the town council and so forth, I want to ask about how politically active Democrats here in North Carolina viewed events in 72. Nixon's election obviously trounces McGovern pretty good.
And more important, Helms beating Galifianakis.
Precisely. And Jim Moulthouse was elected.
Yes.
So can you share your recollections about those events?
Well, my impression, and which is, you know, I went to an incredible number of Democratic meetings, whether they're precinct meetings, county meetings, or congressional district meetings, or state conventions, or even though I was never a member of the state executive committee of the party, I often was available to go as a proxy for somebody who couldn't go. And I can only give you general observations about that because, you know, my focus has always been pretty local. But people were very unhappy with McGovern. They would have been much happier with Humphrey. There's no doubt about that. And they, of course, the party structure largely blamed the McGovernites for the debacle. And I'll admit there was some truth in it. And to give you an example of how they reacted, in those days, in 72 and before, there was no primary then, presidential preference primary. The way that delegates were chosen from North Carolina was based on who went to precinct, county, and congressional district and state conventions. That is, there was a proportion beginning at the county level. If, for example, McGovern got 50% of the delegates to the Orange County Democratic Convention, he would get 50% of the delegates, that sort of thing. Well, the party leadership, which was really, you know, moderately conservative, what they did to prevent that from happening again was they shifted the terms of party officers. They moved them from even years to odd years so that the enthusiast for a presidential candidate wouldn't overwhelm the party structure. And it worked, of course. It was really awful in its impact on grassroots activism. I mean, I remember our precinct meeting. We had 300 people at our precinct meeting in this. There were about 100 organized McGovern, no, 150 organized McGovern people, 100 unorganized McGovern people who had no idea what was going on, no idea that their candidates, people were taking over the prize. And there were about 50 old guard. Now, again, this is Chapel Hill, this is East Franklin. They weren't right-wing nuts. They were just moderately conservative Democrats who were not as hostile to the war as we were, and they were for Humphrey. We have never had, no precinct in this county has ever had 300 people at an annual precinct meeting. We're lucky if we can get three these days. So there's no doubt, and there were all these, what's happened to our grand old Democratic Party meetings in Raleigh and elsewhere in the state in 73, and of course it was the first time in this century that there wasn't a Democratic governor to head the party, and Jim Hunt was the lieutenant governor, and they frankly did not have very good solutions to anything, and they never have since. You know, that happens. It happened this year. It happened after Hunt lost to Helms, and we lost the governorship that year as well, didn't we, in 84? Mm-hmm. So there have always been these series of reevaluations meetings, which are not only boring, which is bad enough, but But they're directed by the wrong people, and they're not directed toward bringing more people into the party.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I want to ask at some point about the Democratic Party's struggle to sort of hold a shifting coalition together against all these forces. So we can talk about that some more. What was Jim Hunt doing in these years to try to position himself to lead the Democratic Party after Holzhauser's term?
Well, what I mainly know, although I know something from these meetings I went to in Raleigh, is when he would come here and speak, and he would try to present himself as the standard bearer of the liberal wing of the party, which of course was not exactly accurate. I remember once when he would have this litany of Democratic heroes, Frank Ram, Terry Sanford, and he threw Dan Moore's name into the, and it was, at least from the rear of the room, it was at the Carolina Inn, there was this gasping. Did he really think that we could swallow the rest of this, but Dan Moore, you know, the person who wrote me a letter, replied to my letter, I was the head of the Tougaloo AAUP, and we had protested the speaker ban. And he wrote this Casey Stengelese response about how we're defending freedom by denying people the right to speak. That was my first connection with North Carolina politics. But I'm sorry, I can't go into much detail about this. I just don't.
Sure. Tell me about your campaign in '79. There you were, stepping into the breach left by Tyndall's choice.
Yes. Well, I really, I don't know if you know Jerry Cohen or, well, he was this little Al Lowenstein in many ways. He had met Al in one of Al's trips to Chapel Hill, and he very much was an Al Lowenstein in the local level in Chapel Hill. He was elected when he was only graduate student. He spent a year in political science before he shifted to law school. And he was an ardent supporter of the bus system, which was this big controversial thing. And he took, you know, moderately leftist positions on a lot of things that came before the local governing board. He had incredible energy, and he had certain ideas about how you ran a campaign and such. And he believed in doing a lot of voter registration. You know, by then 18-year-olds could vote. And by hitting pretty hard on certain issues that would appeal. And doing a lot of door-to-door campaigning. And I didn't have his energy. I don't even have his energy. I mean, he has far less now, and I still don't have as much as he. He's in charge of bill drafting in the General Assembly. But I pretty much modeled my campaigns after his.
Mm-hmm. And tell me about your first 2-year term. How did you think this? What did you learn about the operations of the city and local politics during that first 2-year term?
Well, I didn't really know all that much. I had been on one town advisory board, the Historic District Commission, which, because I was a history graduate student, they assumed I'd had some interest in preservation, which I developed, but I didn't really have at the time. And I had watched the town government working, and I initially had lots of reservations about the manager form of government. It seemed to me that it would be better to have initially partisan elections and a stronger mayor form of government. But I was quickly persuaded in those 2 years that this was a system, a manager form of government, and a pretty progressive local government by the standards of this part of the world. You know, this isn't Madison or Berkeley, but it's also not Siler City or Greensboro. This was a local political system that I found very congenial. And to go back a few years, four in particular, I had known about this incident in 75, although I hadn't participated in it, for one thing, I was still closeted. But in the late summer of 1975, a bunch of students, mainly graduate students, five or six of them, from what was then the Carolina Gay Association, which was pretty new, was less than a year old, went to a work session of the Board of Aldermen where they were discussing a new personnel ordinance and asked if they would add, and they used a term which is pretty unique, affectional preference as a protected class in the town's personnel ordinance. And there were some graduate students from New Jersey who, they knew exactly what they were doing. They had, they were aware of Stonewall, you know, as soon as it happened, they were nearby. And they had read a lot about the theory of gay politics, and this is one thing you should do fairly early on. You should get your local government to take stands on gay-related issues. And I think I've talked to some of these people over the years. None of them live here anymore, but they were really surprised when there was no resistance to this idea at all. In fact, there was another idea. Some other students wanted them to add draft status as a protected class, and the elected officials didn't buy that. That was a federal issue. They were the war was still on, but they didn't take that up. They unanimously included affectional preference in this ordinance, which will be 20 years old in several weeks, and no controversy at all. In fact, this was a work session where they didn't keep minutes, so there's not any evidence that anybody said boo. They just sort of sounds fine to us. Mm-hmm. And the fact that that had occurred and occurred so smoothly made, you know, the closeted Jorisenberg think that this local system was something that was worth